keep eating, and those at the tables just grab a plateful and come and take a seat. A very warm welcome to St. Deb's Church. Welcome to the second of these three lunches. We're calling them Food for Thought. We're tackling three questions that many people ask about Christian faith. Yesterday, the whole issue of spirituality, is the truth out there? Tomorrow, we'll be tackling the issue sex, what would God know? Today, our subject is science, is there room for God? And I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. John Lennox. John is a fellow of Green College and a lecturer in mathematics in the university. He's had a long interest in the relationship between science and religion. And John, we're delighted that you've come. I want to hand over straight to you.
Well, thank you very much indeed. I hope you don't mind the change in accent. The title intrigues me. Science, is there room for God? Because it gives the impression that many people have got today that science and God are competing explanations. Is there room for God? Science explains, God explains. So they're competing for the same territory. And that kind of thinking goes right back to the pre-Socratic Greeks, in fact. Because you will find that one of the early reactions which led to the beginnings of science was a reaction to the kind of thing that regarded thunder as Zeus speaking. And some of the ancient Greeks didn't like this so much and began to look for natural cause explanations rather than simply saying it was Zeus talking or something like this. And so inevitably, as causal mechanisms were more and more understood, you found that there was less and less space for Zeus. And that process we often call the de-deification of the universe, taking God and the spirits out of the universe and trying to understand it scientifically. And of course it has a very large legacy, of which these are two examples. The idea that God and science are competing explanations. Humanity, says Peter Atkins, professor of chemistry at Oxford here, humanity should accept that science has eliminated the justification for believing in cosmic purpose, and any survival of purpose is inspired only by sentiment. And Richard Dawkins, never to be outdone, faith is one of the world's great evils, comparable to the smallpox virus, but harder to eradicate. Now, that can't quite be the whole story. Because when surveys have been done about scientists and their belief in God, the results are slightly surprising. In 1916, there was a famous survey done of 1,000 scientists who were asked, do you believe in a personal God who answers prayer? And 42% of them said yes in 1916. When that was repeated in 1996, the percentage had only shifted to 39.3. And even among top scientists, they reckon about 8% of them believe in a personal God. And at least two Nobel Prize winners whom I know are evangelical Christians. So it certainly isn't the case that the de-deification of the universe in the sense of the ancient Greeks, although it has led to Dawkins and Atkins, hasn't led to no scientists at all believing in God. So let's put the balance. Let's take another example of a scientist equally famous to the other two. This is Professor Sir Gillian Prance, who arguably one of the world's most eminent botanists, director of Kew Gardens he was until recently. For many years I have believed that God is the great designer behind all nature. I made a commitment to Christ as my personal savior while a student at Oxford University. All my studies since then have confirmed my faith. I regard the Bible as my principal source of authority. So here we have two extreme views. Some say science has left absolutely no room for God. And here an equally eminent scientist says all his studies in science have confirmed his faith in God. So one of our problems really is, how can we understand the relationship between these two things? Well, I think the problem lies in the notion that God is an alternative explanation to science. And to think that way is to make what philosophers call a category mistake. Perhaps I can explain it most simply by means of Ford and his car. Now, just imagine for a moment, if you can bear to do such a thing, that I come from some very primitive backwoods of some country, say like Ireland, and I've never seen a Ford car. And you introduce me in Oxford to your Ford, and I say, what is it? You say, it's Ford. Well, what can it do? So I watch it climbing some near vertical slope. And I say, you know, this chap Ford must be immensely powerful to run inside that and carry it up the slope like that. And you say, where did you say you came from? You can't be so primitive as to think there's a Mr. Ford inside the car. Why don't you come and study engineering at Oxford University? So I do, and in 10 years I get a degree. And I come to you, and I say, you know, I do want to apologize to you. I was so primitive. Fancy thinking there was such a person as Mr. Ford. Well, of course not. That was a primitive myth meant to suppress the Irish or something. There's no such person as Ford. I now understand, I've learned it in my lectures, that there is a mechanism. It's called a motor, an engine. And I even understand the laws at which it operates. So I don't need the myth of a Ford to explain it. What will you say about that kind of logic? Because we have a mechanism, therefore there is no one who invented or created the mechanism. That is a nonsense. It's to commit a category mistake. Indeed, you wouldn't have the engine to study if Ford hadn't invented it in the first place, would you? So it seems to me to be very important to bear that in mind, because we frequently get Laplace, the mathematician, quoted in this kind of context. You remember Napoleon asked Laplace when he was demonstrating to him all his results in ballistics, where does God appear in your equations? And Laplace said, I have no need of that hypothesis. And of course, he was perfectly right. If you're explaining how a thing operates, how a Ford engine operates, you don't talk about Ford at all, do you? You talk about the laws of internal combustion. But if you are asked how the Ford car came to exist in the first place, that is a very different kind of question. And so we need as well to distinguish between kinds of question. If we're asking how a thing operates, you will get a perfectly scientific description of it in terms of mechanism. But that does not mean, of course, that there is no agent who's responsible for designing that mechanism. So it seems to me that one of the ways in which we can help ourselves understand the debate is to realize that there are two, at least, distinct categories of explanation which are complementary and do not contradict. But there's a second misconception in this idea of God and science being alternative explanations, and that is that science can explain everything. A famous statement of Bertrand Russell, whatever knowledge is attainable must be attainable by scientific methods, and what science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. That is the view we call scientism, that only scientific knowledge is valid. Unfortunately, and I say this with all respect to Russell as a mathematician and logician, that statement, if it's true, must be false, because the statement itself is not a statement of science, therefore it cannot be known. And so therefore it's false. It's one of these self-contradictory statements. Far wiser, I think, is the statement of Sir Peter Medawar, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine, when he wrote, the existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike questions such as, what are we all here for? And I think it's very important indeed to grasp that science has got limits, wonderful and all as it is. If you just imagine for a moment that here's Aunt Matilda and she's made a beautiful cake, and you have won the Nobel Prize this year, and you're very proud of it, of course, naturally. And I ask you to analyze the cake she's made. Well, the biochemist will tell us about biochemical pathways. The chemist about the elements of which it's composed. The physicist will reduce it to leptons and quarks and protons. And if there were a Nobel Prize for mathematics, which there isn't, they'd reduce it all to equations. Marvelous. A scientific description of the cake. But if I then ask you, ladies and gentlemen, why she made the cake, and you watch her start to grin because she knows and you don't, no amount of scientific investigation will tell you why she made the cake. In fact, you will never know unless she reveals it to you. And that, of course, raises, it's a simple analogy, but it raises big questions. Is there a what or a who stands in the same relationship to the universe as Aunt Matilda does to her cake? And if so, has that someone revealed it to us? So science has its limits. It tends to deal with the how questions, but not with the why questions. Now, the third major point I want to make is that there is a real conflict, but it is not between science and religion. I could probably best make it by contrasting two worldviews. The worldview of the Bible: in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. That's a statement of theistic belief. Carl Sagan: the cosmos is all there is or ever was or ever shall be, at the beginning of his television series, Cosmos. Now, that second statement is a statement by a scientist. It is not a statement of science. And it seems to me that's a very important distinction, that not all statements by scientists are statements of science. In fact, the second statement is equally a statement of belief. They're both statements of belief. The first of theistic belief, the second of materialistic belief. And what I would like to submit to you is that when we look at such statements, and here are two more of them, God created man and woman, of course, in his own image, and George Gaylord Simpson, biology professor at Harvard, statement, man is the result of a purposeless and natural process that did not have him in mind, he was not planned. Here again, we have two statements of belief. One of theistic belief, the other of naturalistic belief. Now, I would want to argue, I think, that the conflict is not between science and religion, but between naturalism and theism, between two worldviews, and on each side you will find scientists. So the question we're asking, not does science squeeze out God, but what we've got is science and the natural world and the study of it, and then two major worldviews. There are others, of course, but two major worldviews, naturalism and theism. So perhaps the more logical question is, with which worldview does science sit most comfortably? Does it sit most comfortably with naturalism, or does it sit most comfortably with theism? So I just want to address that a little bit, because it seems to me that often we can forget some very important facts. The history of science, for example. Why was there a sudden explosion in the 16th and 17th centuries? Well, the verdict of an increasing number of philosophers of science is that it had to do with the theistic background in which the science was done. C.S. Lewis, paraphrasing Sir Alfred North Whitehead, put it this way: men became scientific because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. You just have to look at a list of the famous names to realize that most of these people not only were theists, but they were Christian theists. And there appears to be a link between the Christian theistic worldview and setting people free to actually study nature. Because in a crude kind of way, if you believe that there's a god in the moon, you'd be very careful about studying the moon with your telescope in case you disturb the god and upset him or her, wouldn't you? Whereas if you're free of that and instead regard the whole thing as made by God, and God not in any little particular bit of it, then you're set free to study the wonder of it as part of your worship for God. And I've given you the verdict of some historians of science. Perhaps it'll interest you to see the verdict of another Nobel Prize winner. Thinking about the origin of the belief that the universe is rational, I seem to find the origin of that belief in a basic notion discovered 2,000 to 3,000 years ago and enunciated first in the Western world by the ancient Hebrews, namely that the universe is governed by a single God and is not the product of the whims of many gods, each governing his own province according to his own laws. This monotheistic view seems to be the historical foundation for modern science. Now that's, to my mind, a very substantial point, that we owe, to a large extent, modern science to this worldview. So the crude notion that this worldview is inimical to science seems to me to be a complete non-starter. But then if we go on a little bit and pursue that, there's a deeper point to be made. As I've shown, these scientists of the 16th and 17th century believed that the universe was rationally intelligible. Now that's the foundation of all science. And it's worth reflecting on it, as Einstein did when he made his famous statement, "The only incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible." How is it that my mind in here, as a mathematician, can understand the universe out there? And people who've reflected on this, like Eugene Wigner, who won the Nobel Prize for Physics in a very famous essay in 1961, said the enormous usefulness of mathematics in the natural sciences is something bordering on the mysterious, and there's no rational explanation for it. It is an article of faith. Back that up by John Polkinghorne, who tried to teach me quantum physics on one occasion. Physics is powerless to explain its fundamental belief in the mathematical intelligibility of the universe. Now notice in those two quotes the word faith and belief. There is another curious notion around, that you've got faith in religion and therefore it's not worth tuppence, but in science you've got facts and no faith. That's nonsensical. Every single scientist is a believer, in the sense that every scientist, in order to do science at all, must believe that the universe is rationally accessible, rationally intelligible. Otherwise, we wouldn't start. You've got to believe it before you start. It's the foundation. Now, which worldview does it sit best with? The naturalistic view that tells us that everything in the end is the consequence of just an aimless, mindless becoming and flux of atoms, as the ancient Greeks used to put it? Or the reason that the universe is rationally intelligible is that it's the product of a rational God who created both it and the human rationality that's trying to understand it. We, each of us, of course, have to decide which of the two science sits most comfortably with. So the basic prerequisite for doing science, the rational intelligibility of the universe, seems to point in one direction very clearly. Now, I said when I talked about the Ford car, you have to introduce Mr. Ford when you ask the question, why does a Ford car exist in the first place? And that goes back to the old philosopher's question, doesn't it? Why is there something rather than nothing? Here's Alan Sandage, who won the Nobel Prize's equivalent of for astronomy, the Crawford Prize, who for many years was an atheist, and recently he wrote, "I find it quite improbable that such order came out of chaos. There has to be some organizing principle. God to me is a mystery, but is the explanation for the miracle of existence, why there is something rather than nothing." So this is an astronomer's view facing the question, why is there a universe at all? For him, God is the ultimate answer to that. For him, there is an intelligent God behind the universe. Now, he's not the only one that talks about intelligence behind the universe. Paul Davis is perhaps the most well-known physicist moving in this direction. And he points out to another element, which is part of the debate these days, and that is the fine-tuning of the universe. That in the standard model of the origin of the universe, physicists and cosmologists point to the incredibly fine balance that's necessary in order to have a universe with life in it. Paul Davis talks about the ratio of gravity to the weak nuclear force having to be actually 1 part in 10 to the 40. Siraja Penrose from Oxford again says that if you're going to have a universe with an entropy law, second law of thermodynamics, that is a universe in which even a Porsche will rust. The creator's aim, and I'm quoting him, although he's not a theist, the creator's aim has to be accurate to 1 part in 10 to the 10 to the 1, 2, 3, which, as he points out, if you had a 1 and wrote a 0 in every elementary particle in the universe, you still couldn't write the number out. And his conclusion, and that's the important thing, not my conclusion, but his response to that is, it seems as though someone has fine-tuned nature's numbers to make the universe. The impression of design is overwhelming. Now, to be fair to Paul Davis, he's what I would call one of the new naturalists. He's not a materialist in the sense he believes there's something more. There's some kind of intelligence behind it all. But like the ancient Greek Stoics, in the end, this intelligence, it's superhuman, but it's not supernatural. It's part of the natural processes in the universe. Now, that's interesting because when it comes, and Davis says that he parts company from the atheists at one particular point. He says an atheist will argue that the world is thoroughly rational and logical at every step. There is a causal explanation, explanatory chain for everything, which we can trace either backwards in time to the Big Bang or down to the ultimate laws of physics. But if you ask why the Big Bang or why those laws, you will be told, well, there's no reason. In other words, the laws of physics exist reasonlessly. This was the view that Bertrand Russell took, for example. Having argued that the world is thoroughly rational at all points, the atheist says it's ultimately founded in absurdity. My point of view is that the world is rational all the way down to the lowest level, which is beyond the domain of science. There is a reason why things are as they are. The universe is not just arbitrary and absurd. Physics can tell us about the phenomena of the world, but asking why those laws is the domain of metaphysics, and at that point I would part company with the atheist. Now, I find that very refreshing. But the fascinating thing is when he goes a little bit further, and he says the real issue is this. For 100 years, the debate has been dominated by chemists who think the origin of the universe is like baking a cake. Back to Aunt Matilda, you see. If you know the recipe, you can just mix the ingredients, simmer for 1 million years, add a pinch of salt, and life emerges. I don't think that is ever going to be the explanation. Now, this is very interesting because he's believed it is the explanation for quite a long time. I don't think that's ever going to be the explanation because life is not about stuff, about magic matter. It's about a very special type of information processing system. And the whole subjects of information theory and complexity theory are very much in their infancy. Now, when a mathematician reads that, his or her ears prick up. Because information complexity theory are part of mathematics these days. Now, what I find fascinating, when Davis comes to the point where he's saying, well, what is it exactly then is ultimately responsible? Here is his answer. There is no need to invoke anything supernatural in the origins of the universe or of life. I have never liked the idea of divine tinkering. For me, it is much more inspiring to believe that a set of mathematical laws can be so clever as to bring all these things into being. As a mathematician, I find that almost incredible. I have to read those words several times. Am I seeing things? Stephen Hawking takes a similar view. But just half a minute. I suppose most of us have a bank balance. We know the laws of arithmetic, yes? 2,000 plus 2,000 equals 4,000. Have those laws ever put any money into your bank? No? Laws don't create anything. Mathematical laws are simply descriptions of what normally happens. They don't create things. Newton's laws of motion never made a billiard ball move, did they? They describe what happens when billiard balls are set moving by people with cues. And for someone like Davis, and Stephen Hawking indeed, to suggest that mathematical laws can bring the universe into being, is absurd, but it's fascinating intellectually. Because you see what's happened. We started off with the question, is there any room for God? The people that are insisting on having a naturalistic explanation, what's now happening is they are endowing things with creatorial powers that self-evidently don't have them. So you invent a surrogate God. For Carl Sagan, read his book Cosmos, it's the cosmos does all the creating. For Davis, it's the mathematical laws. So far from getting rid of God, they've got supernatural mathematical laws, which sounds to me like a mathematician, to be totally absurd. You do not escape in that sense that easily. Final couple of points. This is a massive subject, of course. Davis is certainly right when it comes to the fundamental question that we have information processing systems in the universe, and that raises all kinds of issues. And I should just briefly point out that so many people in this debate feel that before Darwin came along, we thought that a benevolent God had created us. But now, of course, Darwin has buried God, and that's that. Well, I'm not so convinced of that either, as you might guess, because I'm giving this talk. First of all, philosophically, to deduce naturalism from evolution, atheism from evolution, seems to me to be a very dangerous thing philosophically, because it's deducing a philosophy from a science. And when it boils down to it, what you're saying is we have a mechanism, natural selection, mutation, genetic drift, and one or two other things, and that means there isn't any God. But think back to Mr. Ford. The existence of a mechanism does not prove there's no agent who designed the mechanism. You say, but there's randomness involved. Yes, there is, and so there is in this watch. You know, self-wind watch, random movements of my arm wind it up. Would you be happy if I argued that no one had designed it? I don't think so. So philosophically, as many people like Sir Julian France and eminent scientists today like Dennis Alexander and Sam Berry and a whole lot of other people have pointed out, that you cannot deduce atheism from biology. Of course, people like me, who are mathematicians, want to go just a little step further forward. Because as a mathematician, I'm not convinced that the explanation is true anyway. What I mean by that is this. I have no difficulty with the kind of thing that Darwin saw brilliantly. Microevolution, the little variations that we see. That isn't a problem. But when it comes to the generation of different levels of complexity, that's another matter. You're probably aware that evolution means at least seven different things. I'm not going to go through them all because we haven't got time. And a lot of the discussion is fogged back because if people are talking about non-controversial things like change or artificial selection, dog breeding, and other people are thinking of chemical evolution, then they're likely to run into difficulty in the discussion. My final point is simply going to be this, that it seems to me when it comes to the origin of information, which we find in the human genome, for example, you've got a linear alphabet which codes for amino acids which in long chains form proteins. It's very interesting that the director of that project, who incidentally is an evangelical Christian, said at the announcement of its partial completion, he talked about our instruction book, getting the first glimpse into our instruction book that's previously known only to God. Now, the fascinating thing about this is that in our genes, there is semantic information. And it's a lovely question to ask, where does it actually come from? Now, that's a big question. And I'm going to simply cut through to where I think the answer lies. Let me put it in terms of a story. I was sitting at dinner in my college some time ago and was introduced to a very eminent biochemist who, when he discovered I was interested in these questions, he said, well, we've nothing to talk about because I'm a reductionist and an atheist. I said, but I'm fascinated by reductionism. He said, are you? He said, what kind of reductionist are you? He said, an ontological reductionist. That is, everything can be reduced to physics and chemistry. Well, I said, I'm afraid I have a problem with the menu. So I held up the menu. said, what's the problem? Well, I said, here is writing, paper and print. I said, you think everything can be explained in terms of physics and chemistry. He said, exactly. So I said, please explain to me the semiotics of the letters in terms of the physics and chemistry of the paper and ink. There was dead silence until he said something I shall never forget. He said, you know, for 40 years, I've gone into the laboratory thinking it could be done. He said, obviously can't. But I said, come on, you know, physics and chemistry have only been going for a few hundred years. He said, no, you can't do it in principle. You need a higher level explanation in terms of an author. Now, you see, at this level, you would never accuse me of believing in a God of the gaps. You know, the thunder is Zeus. If I say to you that the semiotics of the letters is a gap in the explanatory power of the physics and chemistry, that's a different kind of gap. It's simply not within the power of the physics and chemistry to explain it. And I suspect that we're going to find increasingly that that kind of analysis will be applied to the kind of information that we find in genetics. Last minute, another little story. I was once talking about these things to the eminent cosmologist, Professor Chandra Wickramasinghe. And he told me, he said, that the trouble is, he said, you know, I meet these Christians from time to time, and they're so incredibly naive, although most of them are very nice people, which of course was nice to hear. They're incredibly naive, and they will take the Bible seriously. And I said, well, I take it seriously. He said, you're not one of them, are you? So I said, I don't know. So he threw me his chalk, and he said, well, you better prove it to me. I think he immediately suspected me of some serious lapse of intellect or something like this. So I hadn't much time, so I went and I scribbled on his blackboard, and God said, let there be light. I didn't scribble the middle bit, quite rightly so, because that is a classic example of the mistake I was talking about earlier. Equations don't create anything, you see. And God said, let there be light. And he started to laugh. He said, you are one of them. He said, this is ludicrous. Do you think God has a voice box and lungs like we've got? And I said, now you're being ludicrous, Chandra. That's simple language. But if you like, I'll put it up in a slightly more sophisticated language. So I wrote this on his board underneath. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. So what does that mean? Well, I said, Chandra, Word. Words, command, code, logos, the rational principle behind the universe, information. And I didn't get any further. He said, what? Do you think the Bible's got the notion of information? Well, I said, what does it look like? But he said, that's incredible. Does Sir Fred Hoyle know about this? So I said, I have no idea. Well, he said, we better tell him. Because if the Bible's got the notion of information, then that changes my whole view of the Bible. We did eventually tell Hoyle, but that's another story. But the fascinating thing, and with this I want to close, is that you have two worldviews. And if you boil them down, really what you get is something like this. In the beginning was it. Out of it came the bit. It before bit. That is matter and energy leading to mind and intelligence. That's the materialistic worldview. The alternative is the exact opposite way around. In the beginning was the Word, which is much more, of course, than simply information. And the question is, which of those two views fits best with our understanding of science? And I would like to suggest that especially in the last few years of the genetic revolution, it is this one. And indeed, some physicists like Anton Seilinger, professor of quantum physics at Vienna, world famous for his work, is beginning to suggest that the reason energy and so on are quantized is because the fundamental concept of physics is not matter and energy, but is information. And information, of course, is fundamentally quantized because the bit is yes or no. So that's just a few remarks at high speed, I'm afraid, just to suggest to you that it's not a question of there being room for God. As far as I can see, the whole a scientific endeavor is based on a belief that there is a God over all this universe who creates it. And indeed, even more than that, there are certain bits of the universe where one can see traces of his presence. Thank you very much. I'm told we have a couple of moments for questions. So let's see what questions are buzzing around in your heads. I have a habit of collecting a couple of questions and then answering them, you see. So, and we'll be finished at 10 to. So what are the questions? One, two. Yes? Second question? Yeah. Yeah. Right, is there another quick one? Although these are both half-hour questions, I better tackle them first, perhaps. Yes? It's 1 to 10 to the power 10 to the 1, 2, 3. Oh, that's his estimate of the accuracy. It's 1 to that. It has to be accurate to one part in 10 to the 10 to the 1, 2, 3 parts.
What has to be accurate?
Oh, what has to be accurate? That's right. That's right. It has to be accurate to that. Okay, well, let me try and answer those two questions very quickly. The question of what the Bible teaches about these things is extremely important. And when you ask, do they coincide with what we believe, what I've said is, at least today, two things where they coincide very powerfully. For example, for centuries it was not believed that there was a beginning. The Bible has been saying for millennia that there is a beginning. Modern physics took a long time to catch up with that. And even Stephen Hawking, with his imaginary time, believes in real time the universe has a beginning. Secondly, the Bible puts its finger on the central issue. In that sequence of creation days, and God said, and God said, and God said, each new stage is introduced by an input of information and energy from outside. Now that seems to me to be, that is the major emphasis in Scripture. In practically, as far as I know, practically every verse in the Bible, except one or two that talk about creation, it talks about by your word they were, you see. So that this is the exact opposite of a mindless process. This is God at intervals feeding information in. And I would say there is a very strong convergence, because it makes absolute sense, as I was trying briefly to indicate there. Now, of course, there are a lot more details. One might ask about what are these days? And there are all kinds of views about the days. If you want me to say something about them, I will. But I'll come to your question first of all. Evolutionary theory. What it seems to me, and this would really need another lecture, to be fair, and fairness, I would say, is one of the most important things. What Darwin observed, and what can be observed, and what adorns every biology textbook I've got, are descriptions of minor changes. Natural selection and mutation do something. Just look at us. Not all the same, are we? So it's clear they do something. And Darwin loved the illustration of selective breeding, artificial selection, what we could do, and he argued that nature could do it. Now, there are all kinds of difficulties with that argument, as you probably know, because Pierre Grasset, who is the president of the Académie Française and the author of the big standard textbook on biology in all its 18 volumes, was very unhappy about Darwinistic views of macroevolution. That is, the evolution of new body plans, new genetic structures, new information, because he observed, as any medic will tell you, that the vast majority of mutations are deleterious. And if you take something like Drosophila, where you can go through the generations, the fruit fly, where you can go through the generations very rapidly, you find you can produce all sorts of freaks, etc., etc., but you still get only fruit flies. Moreover, he argued, that not only that, but there's a thing called genetic homeostasis. The potential for variability soon begins to run out. Now, Fred Hoyle made a very interesting remark. He said a theory which is based on observation is usually true within the sphere of those observations. Now, that is a very important point. The problem comes when you try to extrapolate. And the question I would want to raise is this: is the mechanism, microevolution, mutation, natural selection, which accounts for variability, does it also account for existence? I would want to argue, certainly at the chemical level, it does not account for existence at all. And there are increasing evidences within science that design, the notion of intelligent design, can be treated as a scientific subject. But I've got to stop there, I see.
Thank you, John, very much. We did say we'd finish at 10:02 because I know some have to get back to work and lectures and things. Do come and grab John. Will you be around for a little while?
Yes, of course.
So if you didn't get a chance to ask your question, do make the most of it. John, we're very grateful to you for spending your time and to rushing through that excellent material.